It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Farmers in Wisconsin and across the country are monitoring the debate on Capitol Hill this week over the future of the Farm Bill.
After two intense days of negotiations, the House Rules Committee advanced a resolution last night allowing debate on the Farm Bill to move forward. If the House passes the massive piece of legislation this week, it goes on to the Senate for consideration.
With about 800 pages and hundreds of amendments, the Farm Bill governs major programs including crop payments, conservation incentives, rural development, and SNAP food assistance.
The Farm Bill typically passes every 5 years, but lawmakers haven't passed this multi-year law since 2018.
A group of organizations representing Wisconsin's ag industry signed on to a multi-state letter urging the bill's passage, and we're hearing from two Wisconsin groups that signed on to the letter. First, Grace Howe is here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Agribusiness Association. Grace, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi there. Thank you. Appreciate you having me on today.
So lawmakers have relied on these temporary extensions as negotiations continue. What is the pressure like from Wisconsin for Congress to act?
Yeah, so the Wisconsin Agribusiness Association is a trade association that represents about 230 agribusinesses across the state. So our members are the folks that are supplying goods and services to farmers to help them, you know, grow crops. But, you know, a lot of people think that the Farm Bill is something that directly impacts farmers, and it certainly does, but it also has a major impact on our members, the agribusinesses that supply fertilizer, seed, and crop protection to farmers. So when farmers face uncertainty like they are today, that uncertainty flows upstream through the entire system, affecting our members as well.
The current Farm Bill extension doesn't expire until September 30th. How crucial is it for this massive piece of legislation to get passed in the House and move on to the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, it's important for our members. You know, they're keeping a close eye on what's going on in D.C. this week with the Farm Bill. You know, we're still operating under extensions of the 2018 Farm Bill, and a lot of things in the economy have changed since 2018. So it's hard to operate under the 2018 Farm Bill extensions in 2026 with more uncertainty and less stability and, you know, changes in prices all the time. So extremely important.
Changes in prices. Yesterday, the national average cost of gasoline hit its highest price since the start of the war with Iran. What impact are these fuel costs having on the businesses that you represent?
Yeah, you know, our businesses are concerned about input costs, you know, fuel being one of them, but, you know, with the fertilizer markets kind of where they're at right now, input costs are extremely high, you know, and that affects the farmers at the end of the day. But it's a major concern for our members as well, is how they're going to get these goods and services to farmers to keep them in operation.
And as the price of crude oil is rising steadily, what is the effect on ethanol producers in the state?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, we've got 8 ethanol plants, you know, not quite as big as some of our neighboring states like Iowa and Illinois, but ethanol is a huge market here in Wisconsin's ag industry. And I think that, you know, some of these Farm Bill provisions could certainly help that industry as well. But they're experiencing a lot of uncertainty and validity as well. So
we saw last night the House Rules Committee including language that would tack on a bill to allow year-round E15 ethanol fuel sales to the Farm Bill. And this, you know, Republican Representative Derek Van Orden of Wisconsin, he's worked on this to push for the sale of E15 ethanol year-round. Could a change in ethanol sales make up for other rising input costs?
You know, I don't know if it'll certainly completely change the scope, but I think it's certainly going to help producers, you know, and those 8 ethanol plants in the state are members of our association. So, you know, ethanol is huge. Year-round E15 is something that is probably long overdue. You know, Congress has been working on this for a lot of years, and whether it gets passed through the Farm Bill or on its own as a standoff bill in the House, you know, we're really backing you know, our federal associations that are helping push this along.
Grace, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Grace Howe is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Agribusiness Association, and we've been talking about the Farm Bill debate in Congress and challenges affecting Wisconsin's ag communities. Now let's turn to Doug Rebout, Janesville farmer and president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. Doug, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
Agriculture Department Secretary Brooke Rollins paid a visit to Wisconsin this week, urging for the passage of the Farm Bill. What do you make of the movement we're seeing, even in the last 24 hours or so?
I mean, any movement out there in Washington, D.C. is good, because this is something that we've been working on and trying to get through, you know, since 2023 when the old one expired. So it's something that we need to get through, and we're hoping that both Congress and Senate can pass this.
What in the bill are you hoping makes it through debate in Congress? Can you give an example?
There's so many things.
I bet.
One of them, you know, as when you were talking with Grace, you know, talking about the impact of prices to farmers. So we need to have our enhancements to improve access to credit for farmers. Because with the way things are going right now, with the economy and price of everything, we need to make sure that we've got that access to credit so we can continue growing these great crops that we grow. And then also, you know, the expansion and diversification of our markets. You know, we are very good at what we do and, you know, growing these great crops. And we need to find more markets, both domestically and internationally, for the use of, you know, crops like soybeans.
Growers, you've touched on some of this, but growers are facing weak crop prices, the uncertainty around tariffs and export markets, elevated lending costs. You mentioned access to credit, you know, some of these challenges. How is the farmer safety net under the current Farm Bill, and what could change?
Well, I mean, there is like you said, an umbrella or, you know, something there for farmers right now. But we need to, there's a lot of farmers that are having a hard time getting access to credit because we do not have the backing or that stability right now. So through the Farm Bill, we're hoping that there is more access and more security for the banks, so the banks can, you know, feel more comfortable loaning the money to the farmers.
We've heard about oil prices, of course, nearly double what they were at the start of the year. How are your rising input costs affecting your ability to prepare for the growing season?
Well, at this time of year, we have to pay these prices. It's going to be at the end of the year or as we go through the year. We're not going to have that extra money to make improvements on our farm, you know, buy that piece of equipment or improve our grain setups and stuff like that. So by having these higher prices, whether it's fuel or the fertilizer, that's taking away from our local communities because we don't have that money to spend back in our local communities at that point. And that's what farmers do. We're very good at supporting our communities and spending money there when we have it.
And Doug, you've had quite a time with the weather recently, these heavy rains this spring that have delayed planting for some farmers in portions of the state. Of course, Janesville area really hard hit with some major flooding in recent weeks. Could a new Farm Bill help with expanded crop insurance support, for instance, or disaster assistance?
Yes. Like you said, down here in Janesville on Friday night, we had in our area, we had 8 inches of rain in 2 hours, and that wreaked havoc in our fields. So just having those programs out there to disaster relief programs available to us so we can get back some of that money because, you know, we're spending extra time out in the fields right now. repairing the damage that was done. So having those programs to help us is benefit or is, you know, critical to farmers.
How are your fields doing?
Oh, we have washes all over. We've been going around fields doing a lot of disking with all these washes, which, you know, we're no-till or minimum till here, but we have to work up the fields because when rains come that hard, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to have washes.
Now, late last year, the Trump administration said it would give $12 billion to farmers to help, you know, bridge payments through market disruptions by tariffs. Have you heard our farmers receiving this money?
Yes, farmers have received, you know, payments from that bridge assistance program. And yeah, it's helpful, you know, helping farmers pay for their fertilizer and seed that, you know, we need, especially at this time of year. So yes, farmers have received that. But we're hoping through the farm bill that we build up programs where we can actually get paid for our products and maybe help bring some of our input prices down, so we don't have to rely on programs like the Bridge Assistance Program.
We've just talked a lot about the instabilities that are facing farmers. You've made a number of examples. What are your expectations for this year's growing season?
Oh, it's hard to tell. You know, of course, farmers were optimistic. We're always thinking it's going to be that great year and everything. Mm-hmm. And so that's the attitude that we have to have right now is we're going to get our crops in, we're going to get those perfect rains, and we're going to have a great season.
Well, I hope that is the case, Doug. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Doug Rebout, Janesville farmer, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. We've been talking about the farm bill that GOP leaders are hoping to advance in the House this week. We're watching that and how its passage could affect Wisconsin's rural communities. We previously spoke with Wisconsin Agribusiness Association Executive Director Grace Howe. Earlier this month, the Senate voted to overturn a Biden-era mining ban in the 225,000-acre watershed surrounding the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northeastern Minnesota. And this week, President Trump signed that resolution into law. Wisconsin lawmakers in both chambers voted along party lines. Republicans in the delegation voted to overturn the ban. Democrats voted to sustain it.
The decision paves the way for Chilean-owned company Twin Metals to apply to build a copper and nickel mine in the area. Supporters of the idea hope for a boom in jobs. Critics worry about pollution and contamination of the Boundary Waters and an economic impact on tourism and recreation.
Wisconsinites make up a large portion of people who flock there every year to paddle, camp, fish, and enjoy nature.
Dan Crocker is a news reporter from Minnesota Public Radio. Based in Duluth, he covers the people, economy, and environment of northeast Minnesota. He's been following this story for a good 15 years now. Dan, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Well, people in Wisconsin, many of them are going to be very familiar with the Boundary Waters. Some aren't, though. Can you briefly paint us a picture of this area and why it's significant?
Yeah, it's a million-acre federally protected wilderness on the border between Minnesota and Canada. It's the most popular wilderness area in the country. About 150,000 people go there every year. It's well known to be a wilderness canoe destination. It's a pretty remarkable landscape of interconnected lakes and rivers, crystal clear, pristine waters, amazing fishing, and really an incredibly unique and beloved area.
The Senate just voted to overturn this Biden-era ban on mining in the watershed near the Boundary Waters. What does that mean for the potential for mining in that region?
Well, that restarts the process where mining companies can submit plans to mine in this area that was covered by the mining ban. And it's a little confusing. Already, mining is not allowed in the Boundary Waters and in a small buffer zone around the Boundary Waters. What this ban did was it banned mining on about 225,000 acres. That's about 350 square miles of land within the watershed of the Boundary Waters. Is a big area of the Superior National Forest, just kind of south of the wilderness. What that means is that if there were mining there, what environmental and conservation groups have long argued is that because it's in the watershed, that means potential water pollution from these copper nickel mines could flow northward and westward into the Boundary Waters and beyond into Voyageurs National Park and up into Canada. So that's the big concern, that pollution, even though the mining would be outside the wilderness area because it's in the watershed, that it could flow into that wilderness area and contaminate some of the waters there.
And this legislation, sponsored by a lawmaker from Minnesota, supported by some business and labor interests. What are you hearing as the arguments in favor of ending this protection for the watershed and opening the door to possible mining?
Well, a couple things. I mean, one, this area where the within the watershed is also where this incredibly rich resource of minerals is, called the Duluth Complex. So there's a lot of potential for copper nickel mining. What advocates would say is a huge opportunity for economic development. There's a long history of mining already up in Minnesota with iron ore, so they see this as sort of a second potential mining boom. It also, these metals are important for electric vehicle batteries, all kinds of green technologies as well. And then they also say that there's a process in place already, that Minnesota has a process where mining companies can submit their plans, and then it goes through a rigorous environmental review and permitting process. And they're saying that mines should be allowed to enter that process. If their plans don't pass muster, then they shouldn't go forward. But if they do, that they should have the chance to open these mines.
You mentioned that tradition of iron mining in that part of Minnesota, also parts of northern Wisconsin as well.
Yep.
I've seen some environmentalists say, well, hang on, there's mining, then there's mining. There's something about the particular type of ore, the process that would be used, that they say would make it more risky. Can you compare and contrast for us?
Absolutely. So that is true, and that's a big point of contention here. This kind of mining is called copper nickel mining for these kinds of metals that are bound up in sulfide ore. And the concern is that when that sulfide-bearing ore is brought up from under the ground and it reacts with air and water, that it can create sulfuric acid and result in what's known as acid mine drainage. And this can leach heavy metals out of the ground and potentially into the water. So it's true, and mining advocates will acknowledge that this kind of mining does carry with it those different kinds of environmental risks. And that's why this has been so controversial, even in northern Minnesota, where there it really is this sort of rich legacy and culture where people are still really proud of the mining heritage, but people are also, this area, as I mentioned up top, is beloved, so people are extraordinarily concerned about the potential pollution impacts on this amazing landscape.
And at the heart of it, it sounds like it's, okay, jobs in mining versus environmental protection, but there's another argument there saying, hey, the environmental purity of the Boundary Waters is also a big economic driver in the area when it comes to tourism and recreation. What kind of economic interests are on that side of the argument?
This is very true. There has, over the years, you know, since the Boundary Waters was created in 1978, there's been a pretty robust economy based on outdoor recreation that has sprung up in Ely and Grand Marais and all around northern Minnesota. It's not just tourists. It's also lots of people who have relocated, second homeowners there and retirees who have been drawn by this landscape. And there have been studies that shown that this is a pretty incredible economic impact, too. And critics of mining will say that all that is put at risk by this potential mining industry. They'll argue even without the pollution concerns that just a bunch of these mines potentially sort of surrounding the wilderness area could be a detractor to that kind of investment and recreational development.
As you mentioned, there would be a state process before a mine would happen. This federal legislation doesn't mean people are breaking ground tomorrow or anything like that. What would the timeline, acknowledging that there might well be court challenges and things like that, what could be the timeline from now till when somebody started mining if a project were approved?
Right. Good point. I've been telling people that nothing is going to happen overnight. This is going to be a long process. I mean, first, Twin Metals, which is the mine that is closest to developing a project outside Ely on the doorstep of the Boundary Waters, they have to resecure federal permits. Then they have to resubmit a plan that has to go through environmental review and then a permitting process. That takes years and in some cases decades, Rob. I mean, there are a couple other these copper nickel mine proposals in Minnesota. One of them was proposed 20 years ago, and that they sort of had to go back to the drawing board because of lawsuits, even after they secured their permits initially. So there's a long process still ahead. The state will have ultimate say on whether this goes forward, in addition to federal regulators also having to sign off on any potential mines in this area. So there is a long story yet to be written.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Dan Crocker is a news reporter from Minnesota Public Radio based in Duluth. He joined us for a look at the Senate's decision to lift a mining ban in northern Minnesota in the area surrounding the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Now to hear how our state fits into the story, we're joined by Johnson Bridgewater, water advocates organizer for River Alliance of Wisconsin and longtime Boundary Waters visitor. Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
This mining project would be taking place in Minnesota, affecting this Minnesota wilderness area. We've heard from Wisconsin listeners, though, who are very interested. Why should people in Wisconsin be paying attention to what's happening over there across the border?
I would start by saying that up north, if you will, northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, the UP, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they all carry a water identity. And the northern region that I'm mentioning, it also has very busy state lines, people traveling across all three of those states daily. I am a perfect example of this. I was born in Minnesota. I work for Wisconsin, but I live on the Montreal River in Michigan. So it is an area that is, as you mentioned, full of special places. The Boundary Waters is a huge one, but you could also name Porcupine Wilderness State Park. You could also name Sylvania Wilderness. You could also name Vilas County, Wisconsin. Those are all places that have in excess of thousands of visitors annually.
What do we know about how popular the Boundary Waters in particular are as a destination for Wisconsinites?
Well, I can tell you this. So there is a massive paddling event in Madison every year called Canoecopia that Darren Bush puts on. In excess of 10,000 people come to that event. This year, River Alliance participates in this event. This year, we had a map up and we asked people to put push pins in some of their favorite paddling places. So even before this conversation that we were having came up several weeks back, people put their push pins where their pocketbooks are. And Boundary Waters was absolutely one of the top three places that people aggregate to for paddling and recreation.
And for you personally, do you have that personal connection to the Boundary Waters?
Yeah, I do. I think anybody who, whether you're from there or have just spent time there, you hear about it. For me personally, and it's hard to talk about, both my parents passed early. It was a place that my father, who was a zoologist, considered one of the last places in North America that you could truly get to someplace pristine that had not been impacted by settlerism or industry.
Now, the mining company, in this case, Twin Metals, says, hey, even with this approval, we're going to have to meet Minnesota's environmental standards. Those are good enough to protect the waterways. Do you think that, the existing kind of state laws in Minnesota could allow for a mine to successfully be in this watershed on the outside of the Boundary Waters and have it protected sufficiently?
There was a study by Dr. Stephen Emmerman who looked specifically at mining in wet environments in our region. So he looked at mines in Minnesota, Ontario, Wisconsin, Michigan. All of these mines that operated, they were metallic copper sulfide mines specifically, operating in wet environments. Every mine studied led to some form of water pollution.
What do you want to see? Now, this could be, as we heard from Dan, a multi-year process. What are you hoping to see as this debate continues in our neighbors to the west?
Sure. So I'll actually throw a kind of a unique wrinkle in. One of the bigger aspects that I know that is being talked about in some circles, but maybe not as commonly known, I would love for people to be aware of the wild rice or manumen economy that exists in this exact same region. And underneath that is the layer of treaty hunting and gathering rights that have long been established for the tribes. So what you're looking at is this overlay of uses that have been functioning and doing what they were intended to do for hundreds of years. We would like to see anything that can be done to stop metallic sulfide mining that could potentially impact these water environments.
Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you all.
That was Johnson Bridgewater, water advocates organizer for River Alliance of Wisconsin and longtime Boundary Waters visitor. Earlier, we heard from Dan Crocker, a news reporter for Minnesota Public Radio based in Duluth. They join us for a look at the decision to lift a federal mining ban in northern Minnesota. It would affect the area surrounding the Boundary Waters, a popular recreation destination for Wisconsinites. We offered an interview to Twin Metals, but did not receive a response to that request. River Alliance of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Around Wisconsin right now, sounds like this one are becoming more common.
That is the call of a rose-breasted grosbeak, courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. These birds are starting to move from their winter homes of South and Central America into their breeding grounds in the northern U.S. and Canada.
You might spot them or hundreds of other migratory birds in your backyard or neighborhood park this spring.
But the birds are also facing threats from pesticides, habitat loss, window strikes, house cats, and light pollution, among others. American and Canadian native bird populations have declined by nearly 3 billion since 1970.
Ryan Brady is with us now for a look at the birds that are traveling through Wisconsin right now and what you can do to help them on their journeys. He's a wildlife biologist with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, set the stage in the skies for us. We know this is migration time. How active is this time of year for our migratory birds coming back or through Wisconsin?
This is about prime time. If you're a bird watcher, you've been waiting all year for this, and we're just about at peak. So right around the end of April and the early to middle part of May is when we have the highest volume of migratory birds moving through the state. And you couple that with many of the resident species, as well as some of the birds that have, are going to stay and nest here as well. And you have literally hundreds of millions of birds passing through the state of Wisconsin of all different types. So it's really an exciting time. Yet at the same time, it's a fairly tenuous time, a dangerous time for many of these birds as they make these difficult journeys.
We'll get into those hazards in just a moment, but what are some of the unusual or rare migratory birds that, hey, if you're going to see them in Wisconsin, this is about the only time you can see them?
Well, not necessarily rare, but you're always trying to catch a glimpse of the ones that are uncommon, yet maybe predictable. A good example would be some of these large shorebirds, a particularly showy one called American avocet. They mostly breed in the plains, and as they migrate between the Gulf Coast and the plains, just a few flocks will stop by Wisconsin, and it's always right around the end of April to the very first few days of May, and you just hope to be there that day when you might be able to see them, especially along the Lake Michigan shoreline. And lo and behold, we had that happen recently, and it could happen again. So that's a good example of how being in the right place at the right time is so important to bird watching and just being out there and spending time in the field. It's a fantastic way to come across species, not only like that, but many of our regular migrants as well that are moving through.
You mentioned perils facing migratory birds. What kind of things have you worried?
Well, first and foremost is habitat. We need to create more habitat for migratory birds. And that doesn't just mean in parks and refuges and public lands. It means in our own backyards. And we can really make an impact in our backyard. So that's important. And we could potentially talk more about that if we have time. But in addition, collisions are a very large problem for birds during the migration season. Collisions with buildings, especially windows. And again, that can be tall buildings in an urban landscape. But it can also be the windows in our own backyards. We've all probably heard that thud and had that sinking feeling when a bird hit our window. And we need to take steps to protect those windows to make them less reflective and keep birds from dying. Because upwards of several billion birds die each year from hitting windows. It is really a major problem. And we can help that too by turning lights off at night. So many of these birds migrate at night. And If we have lights on, it can confuse them, it can attract them. And then when you couple that with the hazards there, like buildings, like windows, or other structures like communication towers, then we have problems and we kill many birds that already have many other challenges that they face during migration. So we have to take a role, whether we have a small backyard in an urban landscape or whether we own hundreds of acres in a more rural landscape.
Let's look at some of those things we can do at home. And you mentioned those building collisions for the daytime. You mentioned the reflectivity of windows being an issue. What's happening there and what can we do? What are some of the practical steps we can take to make that less of a hazard for those birds?
In most cases, birds are seeing reflectivity of habitat that they came from, you know, trees reflecting in the window. In some cases, it's a see-through problem where there's a window on the other side and it looks like they can fly through. And they don't see glass, so therefore they collide with it. We need to remove that hazard by really two main ways. There's multiple ways, but two primary ways. One are small stickers or adhesives, dots that you would put on the window. And the key with those is that you have to space them just a few inches apart. You can't have one large decal, whether it's a hawk silhouette or anything else, because it doesn't cover enough of the window. We need to put these items that break up the reflectivity just a few inches apart. So these stickers are a really good way of doing that, provided they're close together. The other way is something called like Zen wind curtains or Ecopian bird savers. And what these are is essentially like paracord that you hang down from the top of the window. And then again, spaced only a few inches apart, it keeps birds from flying into those windows. And there are do-it-yourself options online that you can find to do these relatively inexpensively, and especially tackle those one or two windows that you know are a problem at your house. You don't have to do every window to start, but pick out the one or two that you know have killed birds before.
And you mentioned lights at night. I know there's a lights out campaign going on. I imagine a lot of us homeowners, I turn off my lights at night for the most part. But then I think I see, you know, office buildings, even smaller office buildings where you see the lights on all night. If people are involved in managing that or a resident, is that something that can make a lot of difference if we get those lights off at night?
It can make a big difference, yes. And so it is very helpful, especially on those high volume migration nights. So even if you can't do every night where you're turning off all the windows, either inside or the external lights, if you could do it during, say, a 4-week window from, you know, mid to late April into the end of May, then you can really lower the impact of collisions on bird populations. And obviously, if you have a taller structure that you maintain, lights that are higher into the air, those can be especially problematic. And if it's a building with multiple businesses and many lights on, finding a schedule and a compromise during those peak migration times, like now, is really beneficial.
We're talking about migratory birds moving through Wisconsin this spring, the threats they face, and what we can do to help them. Ryan Brady is with us from the Wisconsin DNR. Ryan, you mentioned, hey, even in our yards, we can help with habitat. What are some of the things we can do to help those migrators?
The biggest thing you can do is plant native plants. So let a few more parts of your yard go wild, maybe not have as much lawn, and find spaces for brush for trees. And when you do, make sure it's native species. So things like dogwoods and serviceberries and oaks and pines and cherry trees, and trees that are native to our area. Too often in our urban and suburban landscapes, we have non-native trees. These don't host the food that birds need. In particular, they don't host insects because they have not evolved along with the insects that we have here in North America. So when you have fewer insects, you will attract fewer birds. In turn, you could potentially not be providing them the habitat and the fuel they need to either migrate or to raise their young. So really making sure that you're planting natives is the number one thing you can do. Now, in addition, providing things like water sources is helpful. It could be as simple as a bird bath. It could be as elaborate as a small pond. And in addition, offering shelter. So brush piles are really good, dense patches of shrubs, leaving snags that potentially have holes in them for woodpeckers and other cavity-dwelling species. Those are some other options you could take.
Now, I've been in that position planting that serviceberry tree. and I like the tree fine, but I thought, you know, is this really going to make a difference? But, you know, if one person's doing that and then lots of other people in the same community are doing that, that really adds up to make a difference?
Absolutely, without question. And even if it doesn't spread like wildfire, like we hope, each additional native tree that we can add is highly beneficial to not only the birds, but the rest of the ecosystem in our environment. Because like I said, we are not going to be able to do this just by separating kind of our private lives from the world of wildlife. We can't just have refuges. We can't just have parks. We really need to be having an impact at these smaller scales on our own properties.
And Ryan, before we let you go, is there a bird that you have your fingers crossed that you'll spot this season?
Oh, I'm excited to see any bird at almost any time for the most part, Rob. I always look forward, like many people, to the return of the warblers. So 25 to 35 species in the state, many of them very colorful, very active, beautiful songs, and they've spent their winter in warmer places than Wisconsin in the Gulf or in South America. And when they come back, it brightens your day.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Ryan Brady is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Beatrice Lawrence, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.